This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is hour number two of the show. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. Well, it is very clear that the development of antibiotics and of public sanitation have been, in many ways, good for human health. Certainly, they have brought about some very significant increases in the human lifespan. However, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the downside in the war against germs, because we're also coming to understand that the overuse, the indiscriminate use of antibiotics have helped to produce antibiotic-resistant bugs. There is also an increasingly interest in an idea that maybe in our enthusiasm for hygiene, we have made the world too clean, and that also has a downside and has contributed to increases in certain kinds of diseases, inflammatory disease, things like asthma and allergies. This is the territory that we will be exploring this morning in this hour of Focus 580 as we talk with science writer Jessica Snyder-Sachs. She is the author of a recently published book. It's titled Good Germs, Bad Germs, Health and Survival in a Bacterial World, and it's published by Hill and Wang. The book has been out for a little while now, and I'm sure that if you're interested, you can seek it out in the bookstore. And of course, as we talk, questions are welcome too on this program. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So whichever number works for you, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, use the 333-9455. If it would be a long-distance call, use the 800-222-9455. And questions certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of folks is that they try to be brief just so that we can include as many different as possible, different people as possible, and kind of keep things moving along. Just a little bit more about our guest, Jessica Sachs. She is a freelance science writer. Her work has appeared in a number of places, including Popular Science, Discover, National Wildlife, Parenting, and other publications. Her first book was Corpse, Nature, Forensics, and the Struggle to Pinpoint the Time of Death. That was published in 2001, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. Ms. Sachs, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Good to be here.
Something, I guess, one place to begin, which I think is interesting and maybe something that people don't understand as much as perhaps that they should, is that in the world around us, on our bodies, in our bodies, there are lots of bacteria living. And while it is the case that some of these things can indeed make us sick, some of these things actually have benefits.
Right. We've spent the last century studying the ones that make us sick and pretty much ignoring the others, which may make up 99%, maybe 99.9% of all the bacteria we come in contact with. And it's turning out that their relatively sudden absence from our water, which for good reason we sanitize, from our food, which we no longer just pull out of the ground or store crudely in our basements, even from our lives, you know, we don't sleep on the ground or sleep close to our livestock as we may have once done. And that sudden absence in bacteria, they're working out why that is very likely behind the epidemic rise in allergies, asthma, and other inflammatory disorders.
This is something that definitely we want to talk about. Is it the case that if you look at this, something like 90% of the bacteria that's naturally in the world and on us and in us that don't make us sick, is this a matter of that this bacteria just it's sort of a wash, that they don't do anything, or are there in fact ways in which having those bacteria on us, in us, actually produce some sort of benefit for us?
Right. Well, when we're talking about environmental bacteria, of course, most of them make their living having nothing to do with us. And, you know, we have them to thank for the oxygen in our atmosphere and recycling nutrients and all that. But when it comes to the bacteria on our body, and the often repeated figure is there are 9 to 10 times more bacterial cells in your body than human cells, remembering that bacteria are much smaller than our cells, a lot of them play important functions. Scientists are only starting to really figure that out. One of your scientists, Abigail Salyers, is a leader in this field. And so we're piecing together what they do that clearly important in digestion. Mm-hmm. But perhaps one of the most important things of all is they're evolved to live with us. You know, it doesn't benefit them to kill their host. And they form a kind of living mulch that keeps away the bad guys, the invaders that would disrupt their community and harm their host.
This maybe then we should go on here and talk a little bit about what has come to be called the hygiene hypothesis, this idea that perhaps in our enthusiasm for cleanliness and the fact that we don't live as close to the earth as we did, that we wash ourselves, we wash our clothes. And of course, we'd have to say, yes, it's a good thing we're drinking clean water.
Right.
But that what we've done is a lot of this naturally occurring bacteria that would be out there in the world, we've actually gotten rid of it, or at least we've put a big dent in the numbers, and depending upon where you live, it could be that you're just not exposed to the kinds of things that you would have in another time if people who lived differently. So here this idea has started to emerge, and scientists I know are thinking about it and trying to understand it, that in fact maybe in our enthusiasm for cleanliness, we have actually created a problem for ourselves.
All right. And I should hasten to add, it doesn't look like it's a matter of personal hygiene. You know, the person who takes less showers is healthier. More what they're seeing, for instance, and a lot of it has to do with what you're exposed to early in life. Children who are born on farms, especially farms with livestock, have dramatically lower rates of allergies and asthma. And they've measured the differences, and what they find is there's just more bacteria in those environments. Not necessarily bacteria that make them sick, just the kind of bacteria that are around livestock and earth and things like that. The early hygiene hypothesis originally was proposed, well, maybe we don't have enough infectious diseases in childhood. And that was disproven. Actually, the more childhood diseases you have, the worse your inflammation, if anything. Hmm. It's the harmless bacteria.
So that seems to me very an important point to underscore, that we're certainly not talking about going back to the time when we weren't vaccinating, where children where childhood disease was common, when in fact it killed. Something that now people forget is that childhood disease killed a lot of children, that we certainly wouldn't want to. I'm sure you would not want to, and mainstream medicine would not want to discourage people from having their kids vaccinated. We're not saying that would be good if somehow kids started getting measles and chicken pox and all that kind of stuff. We're not talking about that at all. Yeah.
Yeah. And even public sanitation. I mean, you know, people think of antibiotics as extending our lives. What really, really did it was when we started sanitizing our water supplies, and that stopped these rolling epidemics of cholera and dysentery and other things that started when we started living together, crowded into towns and cities with civilization. That's when these horrible contagious diseases started having such a central part in our lives. So in a way, you know, we've gotten rid of the bad guys, but we've done it crudely, and we've also swept away the good guys.
Yeah, and it's apparently it is the case that people started thinking about one of the things that got people started thinking about the hygiene hypothesis was indeed it had to do with people looking at health of children and looking at essentially rural kids and urban kids, and there was this difference, so the doctors were sort of scratching their head and saying, "Well, why should that be?
Right.
That there is this difference?" And then that sort of led to this idea of how is the environment different? How is the way that people live different? And to this idea that in fact that difference could be really significant.
Right, and they'd go into the houses, even, you know, the difference between somebody living in a small town and someone, you know, living on a farm with a cow shed, you know, right attached to their farmhouse. And they'd go into the houses, okay, what's different here? And what they found was this abundance of bacterial markers. You know, even after the bacteria are dead and gone, they kind of leave their chemical skeletons behind, and that can be measured.
It is apparently the case that some particular conditions, allergies, asthma, you mentioned some of the other ones in the book, things like diabetes,
right,
multiple sclerosis, lupus, Crohn's disease, those sorts of things, that if you go, you don't have to go back very far when these things were really relatively rare.
It's really quite dramatic. Yes, the dramatic, the change. Allergies and allergic asthma. Most asthma today is not exercise-induced, but allergy-induced. And that was virtually unknown 200 years ago. Crohn's disease and inflammatory bowel diseases have suddenly become, you know, suddenly over the recent decades become common, and at the same time move down into younger age groups. The epidemiologists see this. Talk to any school nurse, and they'll tell you how, you know, over the last 30 years, all of a sudden they have kids with life-threatening food allergies in all their classes, mm-hmm. kids with serious inflammatory bowel diseases, and they just didn't see that before. And again, there's some really exciting work with, I'll call them probiotics, but we're not just talking, you know, the health food stuff, but really well-studied, harmless bacteria that are used to treat some of these disorders. Very new, some of it very experimental, but exciting.
That is very interesting to me that you would, in a sense, you'd use it kind of like a vaccine.
Right. I mean, what we really are doing is, okay, our immune systems have gone catawampus, mm-hmm. and with allergies and asthma and autoimmune diseases, they're attacking things they shouldn't attack. So how do we get that immune system back on track? And again, you know, getting down, it's very exciting, down to the levels of immune cells and chemical messages between the cells, the effect that harmless bacteria have, they have this immune calming effect that at the same time keeps the immune system on alert but calm, so it's not shooting up the neighborhood, so to speak, not attacking the body's own cells, not attacking harmless substances like pollen or dander.
So in some real way, what we're doing is we're saying to the body, look, don't attack yourself. Here, we'll give you something to attack. Attack
right.
this stuff.
Sort of, but again, that's where it gets mixed up. It's not necessarily a disease-causing microbe that needs to come in. A way to think of it is the immune system, now we're scientists are starting to understand, okay, why doesn't the immune system attack, let's say, all the bacteria in your gut or all the bacteria in your food that doesn't harm it? And because there's like this meet and greet going on between the bacteria that flow through our bodies and our immune cells, and if the bacteria aren't doing any harm, then this calming message, okay, friendly, you know, kind of friendly bystanders, everybody calm down, everybody stand down. And it's the sudden absence of that seems to be caused, leaving the immune system on hair trigger, so to speak.
So that was, I guess, that you're answered the question that I wanted to make sure I got in here, was that as people think about why it should be the case that if we reduce the number of harmless, relatively harmless bacteria around us, why it is that then we should somehow have all these
right.
things, an increase in asthma, allergies, inflammatory disease, these things that are autoimmune related, then that seems to be the answer, that somehow we end up by removing these things, having an immune system that's overstimulated, and that so it ends up attacking the body itself.
Right. You've got inflammation. You've got an immune system on hair trigger. Another way to think of it is to remember that we evolved, our immune system evolved to expect all these harmless bacteria to be there,
mm-hmm.
you know, over the course of the bulk of human evolution. And so there had to be this calming interaction, so it didn't overreact to the harmless bacteria. Now they're suddenly not there. The calming reaction is gone. So then if you have a genetic predisposition, say, in the direction of allergies or asthma or inflammatory bowel disease, you've kind of lowered your threshold, so more people are tipped over that line towards an inflammatory disease.
Yeah, because I think that probably also makes a good point that, in fact, yes, we do think that there is some sort of genetic basis.
Absolutely. Well, we'd all have allergies and asthma or inflammatory diseases. Obviously, we come to this. You're absolutely right, with genetic predispositions. Yeah.
Our guest is Jessica Snyder-Sachs. She is a freelance science writer, and if you're interested in reading some more on this subject, you can look for her recently published book. The title is Good Germs, Bad Germs, Health and Survival in a Bacterial World, and it is published by Hill and Wang. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, someone in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I hope you're going to address the issue of the ads I see on television for bacterial soap. And they want to sterilize us. And I look at that and I think, this is probably the dumbest thing I've ever heard. You do want to build up immunities. You know, by having your body battle these bad bacteria, and I'll take the answer on the air.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question, and I'm glad the caller raised it. I'm sure we would have gotten to that, because it does seem to be the case that now we have more and more products that have some kind of antibacterial component, and they're being sold to us as being saying, well, you know, there's all these germs around there. There's germs in on your kitchen counter, and there's
right.
germs around there, and you'll be doing a good thing for your family if you take care of these germs. And here we've got a product for you to do that. Is this increased use of antibacterials in everyday household products, is that a potential problem?
Potentially. And two things I want to address here. First, again, it's not necessarily that we need the bad bugs to fight. You know, when something actually makes you sick, it triggers inflammation. That's not good. But in terms of the bacteria around, you know, our homes, with the exception, unfortunately, you know, we have we've bred a lot of nasty drug-resistant bacteria into our livestock, so that our eggs and our raw meats are, unfortunately, can have some nasty stuff. So you got to be really careful there. But in terms of antibacterial soaps, there's some real concerns. First, hasten to add, studies show that consumer products with antibacterial chemicals like triclosan and triclocarbon, they don't prevent the spread of illness in consumer products any better than ordinary soap and water. But there's some concerns with them, because triclosan and triclocarbon, they don't act like alcohol and bleach to just obliterate, you know, germs on contact. They act like antibiotics. They target a particular chemical process in bacteria. And as such, at least in the test tube, in laboratory studies, they can prompt drug resistance. Do they do this in real life? We don't know. But if there's no benefit, if they don't prevent disease any better than ordinary soap and water, why take the risk? So a lot of leading experts, including your own Abigail Salyers, who's a great expert on drug resistance and how that spreads, you know, they really, I believe, caution against using, you know, antibacterial chemicals in cleansers and household cleansers and soaps, which is different than alcohol and bleach. And I am one who I will take an alcohol hand sanitizer with me if I'm going to go someplace like the New York subway in flu and cold season and put my hands where 1,000 other people have put their hands that day.
Yeah, okay. Well, myself, I now have recently taken to when I work in the kitchen, and particularly if I'm working with raw meat, to
yeah.
just pour bleach on the cutting board,
right,
and just hopefully that'll help.
Right, things like bleach and hydrogen peroxide cleansers. I was just talking to somebody with the USDA food safety. Vinegar, she was saying, is an excellent thing to clean kitchen surfaces, because it's very acidic, and that kills bacteria. So you don't have to resort to something that has an antibiotic action to cleanse kitchen surfaces.
All right. Let us take another caller here. We have someone in Urbana. Our line two. Hello.
Yes. I haven't listened to your entire program, so I don't know if you may have already addressed this, but I ran across an idea a couple of years ago, which initially sounds absolutely bizarre, but may have a great deal of merit to it. One of the things people had noticed in epidemiology, as you probably discussed, is that the difference between people in unindustrialized areas of the world and industrialized areas was that Crohn's wasn't present in those other areas, the unindustrialized places, but when they would start to clean up and industrialize, they would start to get increasing rates of Crohn's. And one scientist suggested that one of the differences between the areas was that they had almost ubiquitously internal parasites, worms. And so what they did was they took a bunch of people with Crohn's and they gave them harmless internal parasites, and in many cases they would clear up. And what the idea being, what they suspect is going on, is that the worms, the same arm of the immune system that handles parasites, also handles allergies. And so what happens is when you're infected with these, the body tries to get rid of them. The worms counter-secrete a chemical barrage to calm down your immune system. They have co-evolved with us for so long, it became a symbiotic relationship, much like the other flora and fauna in our intestines. And we get rid of them, all of a sudden the thermostat, our homeostatic mechanisms, are out of adjustment. And the next thing you know, people start having all sorts of problems like asthma, Crohn's, irritable bowel disorder, etc. And so what they've been doing at Ohio State and in Europe, in fact, there's one company in Europe, Ovamed, which supplies pig whipworm eggs for people. And what they have been doing is treating people and doing these studies. And there's a number of people who consider it just absolutely, almost entirely certain, one of the major factors behind this has been, as soon as you introduce shoes and toilets and the modern sanitation into areas, the worms are killed off because the way they reproduce frequently is by going through a soil as part of their cycle, people defecating on the ground and you having to get infected in that way. As soon as you do that, you wipe them out, and then people's immune systems are off, and so then they get all these allergic conditions over a number of years later. And that's basically the theory in a nutshell. You'll find that, and this information is out of PubMed. It isn't something that's coming out of crazy websites. It's coming out of mainstream studies that are being done at places like Ohio State. I'm just curious if you'd run across any of that.
Absolutely, and I just want to clarify a few things. The worms themselves don't secrete calming chemicals, as far as I know,
okay.
But like bacteria, like harmless bacteria, Graham Rook, an immunologist in the UK, has used the catchphrase "old friends," and that may sound bizarre to talk about parasites as old friends, but like harmless bacteria in our water and food, this is something that the immune system has had to learn to tolerate. Because if you get infested with worms, the caller's absolutely right, the first reaction of the immune system is what we think of as an allergic response, all this mucus and histamine to try to flush the worms out. But then if the worms take hold, you're going to have real harm. You're going to have a condition like Crohn's disease or ulcers in your intestinal tract if your immune system keeps fighting them. So the immune system is programmed when something just repeatedly stimulating it, it will turn off. So our immune systems will... a lasting parasite infection, like the caller says, like a constant barrage of harmless bacteria, will end up calming the immune system, turning off its inflammatory chemicals. And he's absolutely right. Using harmless parasites, whipworms and the like, have been used. I hadn't heard that it's used for Crohn's disease.
Yes.
Certainly has been used for allergies and asthma.
There's actually a gentleman named Pritchard in the United Kingdom,
right,
who'd written an article which I have not read, but with a title, "Were We Approaching a Symbiotic Relationship with these Parasites?" There was another gentleman who was in fact set up his own company out in Tijuana or someplace. He's on the web, and it was mentioned in Wikipedia. Not that that's the most reliable source, but nevertheless, his personal story was he was dying of asthma. And so out of desperation, he went to South America and deliberately infected himself, because you can't get these through any normal means. 2 billion people in the world have them, but you can't just go to your doctor or pharmacist. And he cured his own asthma.
Now remember, real parasites, the parasites that have plagued us through much of our history, do harm.
Yes.
They can kill children and stunt children. So what these researchers are using is they're using species that, let's say, are more suited like to a pig, and they won't actually give you a permanent infection. So they're more they're very careful to choose harmless species to use it.
Yeah, they're,
you don't want people going out and infecting themselves.
What I think the commentary I heard was twofold. One is that even within those that stay around, there is some suspicion that something like Necoterra americanthus, for example, the American hookworm, if in very limited numbers, is an extremely safe thing. And the other thing is that people have said is that, well, yes, obviously you'd want something like that was temporary, that was very carefully controlled, but if you're dying of asthma or dying of Crohn's, or it's uncontrolled and you have to have major surgery removing large portions of your intestines, the options can get pretty desperate under those circumstances, and people have been going out, in fact, and infecting themselves with worms, and apparently they think, at least in many cases, it's worth the trade-off in terms of whatever risks may be associated with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope we have more progress with the people who are working with the harmless ones so people don't have to take such risks.
Yeah. Well, again, the people who run those websites, oftentimes, if you talk with Pritchard in England, I'm not sure he would say that that particular species is that dangerous, but I haven't investigated it that much. And it clearly is the case if you don't get enough iron, then they can be a problem. But, for example, with Necoterra americanthus, they're so small and limited in number, what will happen is that if you have a pregnant woman who comes back to this country from another country and has been infected, they won't even treat her for them because the medication is although the medication is extremely safe, they consider the medication more dangerous than the worms. So I don't know whether, not being an expert in that area, but I think there's some people who would argue that even with permanent infections, they're extremely safe. But I don't know the details beyond that.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call.
Thank you.
This just invites the question that obviously we really don't want to go back to living in a way where we didn't have clean water and people were going to the bathroom outside and we're going barefoot and, you know, those sorts of things. I mean, we don't want to go back in those sorts of ways.
Right.
But having said that, then the question would be, are there, if this understanding seems to pan out and we start to learn more about it and we do really realize that, in fact, we did have this very beneficial relationship with a lot of these harmless bacteria that we're in the environment and we're not exposed to anymore, then okay, the question is, what do we do with that knowledge? And can we have the best of both worlds?
Exactly. You know, great advances with public sanitation and antibiotics. But now, how can we go from here? And, of course, antibiotics raise a whole other issue because they have some real downsides from antibiotic resistance, which rapidly develops, and also they disrupt our normal microflora, mm-hmm. which is very important in keeping us healthy.
Well, let's go on and talk about that in just a second here, but we're a little bit past the midpoint, and for the benefit of anyone who has tuned in here, I want to introduce again our guest, Jessica Snyder-Sachs. She is a freelance science writer. Her work has appeared in a lot of publications, including Popular Science, Discover, National Wildlife, Parenting, and others. Her first book was entitled Corpse, Nature, Forensics, and the Struggle to Pinpoint the Time of Death. That was published in 2001. And just out, the book that deals with the subject that we're talking about here this morning, that book is titled Good Germs, Bad Germs, Health and Survival in a Bacterial World. Hill and Wang is the publisher. And you can find it in the bookstore, and questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, here we've spent some time talking a little bit about the hygiene hypothesis and the idea that there are these beneficial bacteria out there in the world, on our bodies, in our bodies, and that in our enthusiasm for cleanliness, we have knocked down their numbers, and that may have consequences. Let's talk about this other. There's another big area here that we really haven't, that you just touched on, that we really haven't talked very much about, but that is the increasing problem that we are seeing with drug resistance in bacteria that has to do, in fact, with the overuse of what you have to say have been a good thing. Antibiotics has been a good thing, but that apparently it has been overused, and for that reason, we're starting to see bugs, bacteria, that can cause serious illness that just don't respond to the antibiotics that we used to use against those things.
Right. Again, as you say, antibiotics are life-saving drugs. I'd be dead several times over without them. But we have wielded them in a what-can-it-hurt fashion. Doctors still prescribe them too carelessly, or more recently we have what's known as broad spectrum, or, you know, big gun antibiotics. So, you know, just it'll wipe out whatever might be making you sick, but it'll also really raise your raise your microflora, your protective bacteria, and that can open you up to infections. And it also breeds drug resistance, not only in the bad bacteria, but also in the bacteria in your human body. And your own Abigail Salyers at the University of Illinois has done wonderful pioneering work showing just how easy it is for bacteria in your body, perhaps harmless bacteria, to then share their genes, their drug-resistance genes, with other bacteria that might be just passing through your body. And it becomes an exponential problem because bacteria do share genes. They swap genes between species. So they are accumulating genes for drug resistance all the time. We're all now carrying around bacteria with genes for drug resistance, where if you look back 50 years, we weren't. Mm-hmm. So this is an increasing problem, yes.
So this, to me, is very interesting because as I have, I guess, read about this, thought about it, understood it before, that the process of the development of disease, antibiotic resistance, was just the old natural selection process.
Right.
That is, we have this idea that here we have the population of bacteria, and that there will be random gene mutations there, mm-hmm. and that some number of them, as a result of this process, might develop resistance to the particular antibiotic. So maybe you'll kill off a whole bunch of them, but a few of them will not, and those then will survive. That confers upon them the advantage. They will reproduce, and if you do that enough, what you'll do is breed bacteria that are resistant to that antibiotic that previously had killed them. Now, and that I know that process actually works, but but now, as a result of looking at the book, I now get this increased appreciation that there's also something else going on, and that is that thing that you just talked about, that in fact bacteria can swap their genetic material. So not only would you have one particular kind of bacteria that through this process had mutated to the point where we have them resistant to the antibiotic, that they can then exchange that resistance with another bacteria so that that bacteria doesn't have to go through that process.
Exactly.
It can pick up that resistance, just like, you know, the one bacteria can say, hey, here's some good stuff.
Right. Put this into your genome,
and you'll be in great shape.
Yeah, and now we have, for instance, Salmonella bacteria. You know, the most common cause of food poisoning in our country is Salmonella, or certainly one of the most common causes. There are some nasty strains of Salmonella out there that have these little supplemental circlets of genes called plasmids, and they have plasmids dripping with drug resistance genes, up to 15 or more genes giving them resistance to different drugs. And a Salmonella bacteria can meet up with an E. coli bacteria, and as you say, here, slip a little of this into your genome.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Abigail Salyers, she clocks these kind of exchanges. She studies transposons, yet another way that bacteria exchange genes, you know, in a matter of hours. Sometimes even minutes, bacteria can swap genes.
Let's talk with another caller here. We have somebody in, someone in Champaign, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was just wondering, when you talked about the food supply, if there's a role for, there's an increase in organic gardening, you know, at people's own homes, and then in community-supported agriculture, where people go together to support a small farmette kind of thing, that does the horticultural work, provides the vegetables, but they're, you know, organic. And I, you know, being people who for, you know, several months of the year, the vegetables we eat are all ones that we've grown. And I'm wondering if that kind of horticultural practice can have a beneficial effect on the good bacteria that we take in.
It appears so, especially, again, early in life. For instance, some of the studies were comparing East and West Germany after the Berlin Wall fell. Mm-hmm. At the time, and this was about allergies and asthma, and at the time they expected asthma rates to be much worse in East Germany because it had such horrific air pollution. And at the time, asthma was thought, you know, largely the result of air pollution. But instead, they found the East German children had much lower rates. And among the things they thought responsible, one, they were in daycare together from an early age, so they were exposed to the germs from other kids. And also, rather than eating, you know, sterile, prepackaged food, families were largely getting their produce from farmers' markets.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I suppose while we're at it in here, we're talking a little bit about agriculture. We have to acknowledge, have to just mention the fact that one aspect of overuse of antibiotics has been in agriculture, where they've been given to animals, and I'm sure that mostly what we're talking about is very large-scale operations to raise animals, because they discovered that it would promote growth.
Right. Little understood effect, but in young animals, antibiotics, low doses of antibiotics will speed their growth, so they reach market size faster, and that saves the farmer so much money per animal. And here in North America, both Canada and the United States, our big factory farms are very much dependent on that. Then on top of that, you have animals living in very crowded conditions, so that's the kind of conditions where infectious diseases do race through herds and flocks. So as soon as you see one chicken snicker or one calf with a runny nose, you know, the farmer is likely to put antibiotics in, treat the whole herd, treat the whole flock, so that disease won't spread. And so we have bred highly drug-resistant bacteria into our livestock.
Mm-hmm. And certainly, though, going back to the wouldn't want to diminish that problem, but we also have to acknowledge just how significant an issue this has been in human medicine, with physicians perhaps indiscriminately giving antibiotics, in part maybe because of patient demand, because
right,
people have asked for them. One, I think, important point though here is, did we, within the scientific medical community, recognize there was a problem, or that there was a potential of a problem early on, and in a very real way ignore the fact that we were headed?
Yeah.
We sort of said, you know, if we keep on doing it like this, we're going to have a problem, and we knew that, and yet we kept on doing it like that anyway.
Well, you're absolutely right, because go all the way back to Alexander Fleming, the developer of one of the discoverers of penicillin. He was, you know, railing against, once we got out of World War II and production of penicillin really ramped up and it was starting to be used for everything. At one point, there was even a penicillin toothpaste, and he was railing against this because already then he saw and he knew that resistance develops. And so, but we had this pharmaceutical pipeline going, and this great hope that there'd always be a new antibiotic to come into place when you hit resistance to the old one. And also, I think what wasn't appreciated, what you described, people knew that bacteria mutated, but slower was the realization of how rapidly they can swap genes.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that fairly recently there's been a lot of coverage in popular media of the problem of the methicillin-resistant staph,
yeah,
the MRSA germ.
Right.
And one of the things that I was really struck by in looking at your book was, in fact, people had been aware of MRSA as far back as the mid-1960s. It's not something that just came along within the last year.
Right. As soon after the introduction of methicillin and its whole family of drugs, resistance appeared. Initially in hospitals, we've had a serious problem with methicillin-resistant Staph aureus in our hospitals. And in the last 10 years or so, distinct strains, different from the hospital strains, have risen in our communities. They're not as multi-drug resistant, but unfortunately they carry some toxin genes. They're really nasty bugs. So when they do cause infections, they can cause very aggressive infections and rapidly sicken and tragically sometimes kill previously healthy children and young adults.
Mm-hmm. I certainly do not want to do anything to be critical of the medical profession or of doctors or hospitals. But having said that, sometimes I'm sure only half jokingly doctors talk about the fact that, you know, probably the last place you want to go if you're really sick is the hospital, because obviously there are sick people concentrated there and there are a lot of germs. I think in the infection control, you know, that's always an issue, but it seems that we're even coming to understand more and more just how complex that is, and right. that by doing having people who are healthcare providers do relatively simple things. I mean, we're not talking about anything that's maybe all that complicated, but much more in a sense vigilant about those sorts of things that some significant amount of limiting of spread of infectious disease can occur just by again doing really simple things. I guess though the thing is that if you work in a big clinic or in a hospital and you're the person who's in charge of infection control, you got to constantly be nagging right. The doctors and the nurses and everybody else and saying, look, we just have to do these things. It's not that complicated, but you just have to make sure that you do them.
One of the counterintuitive things that they've discovered and now slowly putting in place in hospitals is that getting patients off of antibiotics and avoiding unnecessary use of really powerful antibiotics is often the best thing you can do to prevent infection. That sounds strange, but when you use antibiotics that wipe out the patient's normal bacteria, then you open up parking places for those super germs that we've bred and that have become residents in our hospitals.
Let's talk with another caller here, and I think this is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
A moment ago you said that the MRSA that's loose in the community can have tragic consequences for children and young adults. There's an implied distinction there between younger people and older people. Was that intentional?
I'm not saying that it can't strike older people. What is unusual, staph pneumonias, for instance, have been long thought of something that strikes old people. You know, like we tell old people to get flu shots, mainly so they won't get bacterial pneumonias because they can frequently prove fatal in older people. But these new staph strains, MRSA strains, that are circulating in our communities, because they are so aggressive, they not only can kill old people, but also previously healthy younger people. And one of the best things you can do, one of the few things you can do, is get a flu shot and protect yourself from flu. So I think flu shots are good for people of all ages now, not just the elderly.
Okay, so it's people of all ages that are at risk, and you were just emphasizing that now it's younger people as well as older people.
Right. There may be some, and now I'm going out on a limb, with some infections do strike younger people. It seems harder than old. That the flu pandemic of the early 19th century was an example. It's because what's ultimately killing the patient is their own immune system going into overdrive.
Uh-huh.
And so sometimes there is that, you know, a younger person can have a stronger immune response and be more apt to go into what they call septic shock or severe sepsis. can we say, but I don't want to go and say that MRSA is more apt to kill younger people than older. We don't know that. I don't think the science is there.
Okay. I had had an impression that the staph infections were mainly skin infections.
Mainly, yes. That's the most common. But on the heels of a respiratory infection like the flu, MRSA can invade the lungs, and it seems I've heard some researchers call it like a perfect storm when you have both flu and MRSA in your body at the same time. That's when you can have these very serious pneumonias and body-wide infections.
Okay, it's very obvious how one can pick up skin infections. How would one contract an MRSA respiratory infection?
You would already have the MRSA on your skin or maybe in your body, and normally your body would just shrug it off. But
I see you have it on your fingers.
Then you're weakened by the flu comes in, changes conditions, and then the bacteria can flourish. Okay. And it's something to remember. A third of us at any one time are carrying around Staph aureus in our nostrils or on our skin. It's the most problematic of the so-called normal bacteria on the human body.
Okay.
And now that MRSA is moving into our communities more frequently, this is the strain we're carrying around.
I see. With respect to the immune system being the killer in things like severe flu, I've read that many people these days are deficient in vitamin D, and that vitamin D is, among other things, an immune regulator, and that if one is vitamin C adequate, that it's much less likely that this immune storm would be a problem.
Were you saying C as in cat or D as in dog?
D as in dog.
What I've learned about vitamin D in researching this book was not so much about it being a regulator, but actually that it's strengthen some of the immune cells that are at the front lines, front line of attack before things go so bad, like to severe sepsis. And this makes a lot of sense. You know, think back to the TB sanitarians, sanitariums, and the sunshine cures. Vitamin D has this enervating effect on some of those front line immune cells.
Mm-hmm. Finally, I'll comment. I'd have been expecting all through the program that you would be saying something about the notorious inclination of little babies to put everything that they can find into their mouth.
Yes.
And that this is probably part of the way that the body protects itself by educating the immune system. And unfortunately today there are so many dangerous things around that we have to try to prevent children from doing that, because there's so many chemicals and things.
No, but chemicals, you're right. I wouldn't prevent children from doing that because of bacteria, you know, on their parents or around themselves. But, yes, I've heard many microbiologists, especially the microbiologists who study the microflora of the human body, talk about that instinct that babies have to just touch everything and put it in their mouth. And, yes, those first weeks of life are when we are colonized.
Let's take one more caller before we run out of time. In Chicago, line 4. Hello?
Speaking of things we put in our mouth that can endanger the immune system, could you comment on the role of sugar in suppressing or lowering our body's immune system to the degree I'd heard and read that for maybe 5 or 6 hours the body's immune system has been significantly lowered because of indulgence in sugar and also alcohol?
I'm not familiar with that research. Not that it's not out there. It's just not something I have delved into or talked to many researchers doing that sort of study.
We're coming down here to the point where we're almost out of time. There are certainly a lot of things that we could talk about that we haven't managed to get to, including the interesting question about, you know, why is it that we know that there are people who are carrying around on them, in them, potentially harmful bacteria, but they're feeling just fine. You know, you'd say that you could culture them and you could find all this stuff, and then you'd say to them, "Well, how do you feel?" And they'd say, "I'm okay." So obviously, there's some kind of great mystery going on there.
Right, huge mystery, and very promising, because why is it that one person shrugs off, you know, a bacterium and another doesn't. Now, part of that is nature has built a great variety in our immune systems, and that makes sure that no one bug will ever wipe us all out. So we inherently have different immune systems.
Yeah.
But why does one person tolerate a certain bacterium in their body and it, they get along fine, and in another person it triggers inflammation? For instance, heart disease, increasingly people are interested in the inflammatory component. You know, is some of the plaque in arterial disease a response to bacteria in the body? Well, why would that be in one person and not another? So it's a real rich area for further research.
Yeah. And then just as a way of finishing up again, if one asks this question as an individual, what can you do for yourself other than watch out for, you know, you probably don't need 1,000 antibacterials in your household products, and don't, every time you feel sick, don't go running to your doctor and ask for an antibiotic. Is there much else other than those two things?
Right. I would encourage people to have conversations with their doctors, however busy they are. If your doctor does prescribe an antibiotic, I'm not saying don't take it, absolutely not, but talk to them. Do I really need it, or is this something where we can wait and see? And if you do need it, is this something narrowly targeted to take out the bad, you know, the bad guy without disrupting my good bacteria? Can you prescribe something that's, you know, less disruptive of my good bacteria? These are the kind of conversations that people can be having with their doctors.
All right. Well, and if you'd like to read more on this subject, you can look for this book that we have mentioned, Good Germs, Bad Germs, Health and Survival in a Bacterial World. Hill and Wang is the publisher. And our guest is the author, Jessica Snyder-Sachs. She is a freelance science writer, and thanks very much.
Thank you.
Programs here on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming the Eroica Trio, Rosario Andino, Hava Alberstein, and the Turtle Island Quartet during the month of November. More information available at KrannertCenter.com. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine, and the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we're going to hear about one of the worst battles of World War II. It is a battle that is largely unknown. It happened on U.S. soil. 3,000 Japanese soldiers invaded the Aleutian island of Attu in Alaska in 1942. In 1943, the U.S. retook the island. Two guests will join us this afternoon. One is a veteran of Attu. His name is Bill Jones. Also joining us will be one of the filmmakers of a documentary about the battle, Matt Radecki. The battle documentary, Red, White, Black, and Blue, and it will be shown tomorrow on our companion station, WILL-TV. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. December wheat, $7.96. That is down 15 and a quarter. That in Kansas City. In Chicago, December, $7.71, down 16 and three quarters. March, $7.91, down 17. July, $6.83, down 8.5. December corn, $3.87, up 2 and three quarters. March, $4.04 and a quarter, up 3.